My name is Mildred, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. As is the custom, obviously, my dry date is May the 18th, 1973. I belong to the Rocks Glen Traditional Group in Toronto. I'm an active member there. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor others. And I'm glad to be here. I feel like Marty said last night, you know, he has ties to Florida. My tie to Florida is the same as his. Wesley Parrish was a big figure in my life. When I was very, very sick, and you may find out by the time I'm finished that you still think that's the case, which is fine, but there was a time when I was doing some things in Alcoholics Anonymous that weren't the right things to be doing. And I was taken to a banquet in Brandon, Manitoba, and Wesley was the speaker there. And he didn't do the old violin that night. What he did was he talked about being so upset, new in sobriety as he was way, way back. And there was a woman in Florida. I don't remember her name, but he went to see her because to him, she radiated what the program was all about. And he thought maybe if he could talk with her, he would go to her house, and if she would chat with him, he might get the message. So he got there, and she had somebody else in the kitchen. So she said to him, "Just go sit in the living room for a bit, and I will come. I won't be long." And he went and sat in the living room. And he looked at a picture on the wall. And it was the picture of a storm at sea. And there is a boat turning with or moving with the turbulence. And the Prince of Peace is standing at the tiller, and underneath it said, "Peace, be still." And he said something happened to him. And he said by the time the woman came into the living room, he said, "I had had my answer." However, he said, you know, we talked a bit, but he said, "I had had my answer." And to an extent, in Wesley's telling that story, I had my answer. I cried and cried and cried, and when we went up to thank the speaker after a while, he said, "Come, you sit here for a bit. I want to talk to you." That was vintage Wesley, when he saw you were in trouble. And so he took me by the hand when he was finished, and we went off and had some coffee, and he said, "You know, you're doing some things that are not going to help you in practicing this program." But he said it gently, he said it kindly. And he said, "Whatever is wrong with you," he said, "the Prince of Peace can take care of it." And so we had that conversation. And when I got home, there was something in the mail for me. It was a huge picture of that same picture that he had seen in her living room, with the boat being tossed by the stormy seas and the Prince of Peace at the tiller, and underneath it said, "Peace, be still." And, you know, I relied on that picture for a long, long time, and always on the message. And as the years went by and I got truly sober, Wesley was my biggest cheerleader. He'd write to me frequently. He'd send me stuff, and he'd say, "Keep coming back." You know, I was 3 or 4 years sober speaking at a convention. I can't even imagine what I might have been saying. But Wesley was kind. He'd always say, "Keep coming back. We need you." And I'd go home shaking my head saying, why does he need me? I understand it today, you know. 34 years sober, and to those of you who are new, I can say to you, keep coming back. We need you. So it's wonderful to be here, and I thank Lee in absentia and the committee for their kindness in inviting me. It's been an absolutely incredible weekend. Some of my favorite people in the whole world are here. My best friend, Rick, it's always a pleasure, you know, to share a conference with him and his surrogate parents. And then there's Mari from my hometown, and Scott and Kim, and, of course, Marty, and all the rest of the speakers, too. Some of I haven't heard you all, but I have heard most of you. It's been an absolutely wonderful weekend. Marty and I have shared a path for a long, long time, and it's just great to be here with you, Marty, and to hear you again. Haven't heard you for a long time. Where do I start? Well, let's start 1966. I came charging into Alcoholics Anonymous with almost the same enthusiasm that I used to charge into a bar. And you may say, this woman must be nuts. Well, there's a reason why I was so excited. I was in big trouble. I had had all kinds of people in various disciplines trying to help me, and I wasn't getting better. I, by this time, had had 32 hospitalizations in one psych ward, mental institution, or insane asylum. Yeah, I did say 32. I had been 15 years in a convent trying to find my answers there. I had had 38 shock treatments, and you heard that one right, too, and I'll tell you, that will put a light into your life if you need it. I had been diagnosed with what I think is just about every mental illness in the psychiatric roster at that time. They had tied me to the bed, and trust me, it wasn't for fun and frolic. They used to put me in those cold water baths, you know, till I was just kind of stiff and all the violence would have gone out of me, and then, you know, they'd put me to bed, etc. I hadn't married my psychiatrist by that time, not yet. Was on the way. That is a sure sign of being not too smart. So, I charged into Alcoholics Anonymous. Why was I so excited? Well, I have a brother. I left home in 1950 and to go to the convent. And when I left, my father took me aside and he said, say goodbye to your brother. You may never see him alive again. Remember, this was 1950. I'm not sure exactly what year AA came to the prairies. I was born in Saskatchewan, which is a province I'm talking about. And my father, nobody knew what was wrong with my brother. They said it was his heart. They said it was his kidneys. They said whatever it was, he was dying. I never heard, you know, that alcohol was the problem. I knew he drank, but nobody seemed to zero in on alcoholism. And then, 2 years after I had gone to the convent, I get a call from my dad, and my dad is crying. And he said, there's been a miracle in our family. He said, your brother doesn't drink anymore. He said, something has happened. He has been transformed. That was the exact word that my father used. He's been transformed. He said, there's this new thing on the prairies. They call it Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, I don't know what it is, but he said, it's good. You know, my father was to live another 13 years after that, and my father could never mention Alcoholics Anonymous without crying, because every time he said it, the miracle of what had happened became alive for him. My father died before my disease became as obvious as it became, but he passed the message to me. So I have come from what was Ontario's insane asylum. I'm at the University Hospital in Saskatchewan, and there is a doctor on staff there, Dr. Abraham Hoffer. Dr. Abraham Hoffer was one of those people that Bill Wilson had consulted about taking LSD. And that was before LSD went to the streets and it was outlawed, and his whole program was outlawed at the time. Interesting, a couple of weeks ago, he was in Toronto to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Society of Orthomolecular Medicine, and I was absolutely delighted to hear that. Anyway, he was not my doctor, but he went to my doctor and he said, you know, we've misdiagnosed this woman. He said, I don't think she's all these things that she has been diagnosed at. I think she's alcoholic and should go to AA. And good old Dr. McCarricker, who was chief of staff and obviously did not know about Alcoholics Anonymous, said, oh, he said, we couldn't let her go to Alcoholics Anonymous. It would interfere with her treatment. I've told you what my treatment had been. What I forgot to mention was hundreds of hours of therapy, people trying to help me. And so Dr. McCarricker eventually relented, and I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous the first time so happy and excited. And you know why? Because my dad said, you get transformed in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm up for that. I knew I was in trouble. I knew that people were talking about me. I wanted to be nice. I wanted to get past this stuff. I just didn't know how. And so the problem was I had a misconception. I thought that all I had to do was park my hiney, and that somehow or other you were going to sprinkle something on me, or you were going to tell me something. I didn't know how it was going to happen, but I had not an idea that I was going to be part of what was going to happen. And if I didn't do anything to change, nothing was going to happen. I loved AA for 3 weeks. I just sat there and everybody made a big fuss about me and I was thrilled. And that's about as long as it took for the disease to really show up. Because, you know, the book says drinking alcohol is only the symptom. It's not the problem. You know, drinking alcohol was my solution. It was my anesthetic. It was that thing that gave me ease and comfort. It was that thing that enabled me to function. It was that thing that smoothed me out. And people liked me in one sense. If you got me before I went nuts from the booze, you liked me much better if I was drinking. So I sat there and decided that I needed some help. So I knew that there were things on the planet that you could take that changed the way you felt. So I sat there for 5.5 years stoned. This interferes somewhat with the way you see the program. I read the book. I even attempted a fourth step. I even attempted a fifth step. Cease used to let me go do 12-step work. I used to go out to the women's jail every week, regularly. He now says I carried the disease, not the message. But I went anyway. And after 5.5 years, I couldn't stand one more time. The game was over. You know, those were the days when Chuck Chamberlain used to come to Prince Albert. Wesley Parrish came on a regular basis. Willard Pegg came on a regular basis. All those great people, Mac Cheater was still alive. Tommy Breen used to come. And I'm mentioning men. I didn't like women, first of all. Secondly, there weren't many sober women coming to Prince Albert at that time. I don't know if there was anybody with continuous sobriety. So anyway, that was the condition. I'll get back to that as I tell my story. How did I get to be such a mess? You know, I had every opportunity. My father had lots of money by this time. I had the opportunity to go to school. I could have done anything I wanted. My father always said, you know, you can go wherever you want. Instead, I went to that convent. How did I get so muddled up in my head, so afraid of life, so afraid of people, so unable to form relationships, so unable to be okay with just the ordinary things that people do on a daily basis? I woke up to consciousness when I was about 3 and a half and I was crying. I was lying in my bed with my sister Dora. Dora is a big piece of my life. I think she was sent to this planet as my teacher. Dora was injured at birth. She couldn't learn as quickly as other students, and therefore they kept her in grade 3 till she was 16. Dora cried a lot. I cried with her, and I gave my family their marching orders because I thought those big brothers and sisters of mine, they could fix this. The problem was, you know, you fix this. I'm just a little girl. I can't fix it. And I understand now what I really absorbed from that experience, because they couldn't fix it. And we lived in a time where people didn't talk a lot about what was going on. You know, it wasn't, I think, that my family was that much different. People just did what they had to do, and they weren't into processing their psychological stuff around things. And so I lived with the thoughts that I took on. Nobody cares about me. If I were important, they'd do what I want. I just asked a simple thing. Help Dora to stop crying. That's all I wanted. Simple enough. And it didn't happen. And I grew up as a child of fear. I grew up as a child of rage. I grew up as a child filled with despair. And, you know, some people take that kind of feeling out. I buckled it in because I was raised in a home where children should be seen and not heard. And so whatever was going on the outside, what you saw was a pretty little girl. And my brothers and sisters used to say, "You're so lucky, you're so pretty, and you're so smart, you'll be able to do anything you set your mind to." And I'm thinking to myself, "And you're so stupid. Don't you know what's going on inside me? I'm dying." And I didn't know how to handle that, and that's how I lived. I understand something today. I understand why my life went off the rails. I understand my difficulties in relationship. I understand what happened to me, because that was the energy I put out. You can be very smart, and you can be the kid who always gets 99 or 100 in the classroom, but when it comes down to the ordinary living things, I didn't even as a child, because I didn't have, we lived on a farm. My father owned a lot of the land around. We didn't have a lot of little kids that I could play with. I didn't learn how to do that. And so my weapon was my intellect. Now, at 5, I took a drink. And that was the best thing that had ever happened to me. Because when I took that drink, I believe I didn't slip into alcoholism. I was alcoholism waiting to happen. And when you added the drink to me and to my personality and to my way of thinking, you see, because it's in our genes, it certainly is in my genes, and you put alcohol into me, and the amazing thing happened. And I'm not going to take a long time to discuss it, except to say the world changed. It was as if I had these dark, dark lenses on. And then you put this booze into me, and now these lenses are pink and everything looks rosy. I just love the world. And the world loves me. There's just not enough of me to go around. There's no problem with anything. I can handle Dora. We're going to fix all that. It's all going to be fine. See, that was what I chased. And the day came when I would sell my soul to get that alcohol, because that was the feeling. I couldn't seem to get any other way. Without that, I was just like my alcoholic brother before he sobered up. He was two people. When he was sober, he was quiet, he was self-conscious, and I know now, he lived in a cage of fear. Same as myself. When I drank, I came out to party. And it was nice for a while, until I got onto the table and started dancing on the table and God knows what else. And then the day came when the violence followed that. But that was to be a long way in the distance. So I didn't fit. I didn't fit. My saddest memory is running across the playground after a couple of kids saying, "Why don't you love me? Why don't you like me?" I bet there are a lot of people identify with that. And they'd turn around and just laugh at me. And I'd reach into my pocket. I had my last weapon in my pocket. I had money. And I'd say, "I'll buy you stuff if you'll come and play with me." And they'd run anyway. And I felt just, how do you describe that kind of devastation? And so, when I was 18, I was out of any kind of ideas. We were raised Roman Catholic. We went to church, and I'm not one of those who heard that God was punishing. I heard God is love and God is power. Whoa, I've got my answer. I'm going to tell God about Dora, and God's going to fix Dora. Then she's going to stop crying. I'm going to stop crying, and everything's great. That was my plan. It didn't work. Nothing changed. You and I know we've got a journey. Dora had a journey just like you have one, just like I have one. And that was her path to find some peace in her life. The problem with the God thing was I also saw something else that confused me. Saskatchewan has unbelievable sunsets. Isn't that right, Marty? Unbelievable displays of the aurora borealis at night. And I used to sit there at night and watch this with my cup of home brew on the woodpile, and I'd be looking at this stuff and saying, how is this possible that a God of such incredible power and such incredible beauty allows my sister to be where she is? And I thought, you know, there's something I'm missing. And my conclusion was, I'm going to go to a convent, and did I need poverty, chastity, and obedience? I don't think so. Did I need monastic discipline? I don't think so. I didn't want it either. But that was the price I was going to have to pay. Because if I do this hard thing for God, then God's going to fix it. And you know what? That is precisely what happened. God did fix it, but not in my way and not on my time. See? So I stayed in that convent. I was drunk the night I entered, and they took me anyway, which probably says as much about them as it does for me. And I did not want for booze in the convent. And if you want to know about that, come see me privately, and I'll tell you how that work was finished. One thing I can tell you, mass wine has a high percentage of alcohol. And I always had all the jobs in the church. And if I overindulged, I could always go sleep it off in the confessional. Parishioners brought me booze. They said, "Oh, Sister Eugenia works so hard. You need a little nip now and again." And so all the mothers and fathers of my students were bringing me booze, and I was okay with that. I left the convent January the 10th, 1966. I see it as I stand here. I'm as clear about it. I stood on the convent steps, and I was a well-educated woman. I'd spent a lot of that time at university. I had studied all kinds of things, including theology, and I didn't know a thing. I thought the problem was out there. I remember standing there thinking, as I was waiting for the car that would whisk me to my new life, I remember standing there thinking, I wonder where the man is who's going to be my husband or my boyfriend or whatever. I thought that's what it takes, guys. It takes a man. Yeah, right. I love you, but you're not my solution. Where I found you was at the bars. And I can tell you the next 10 months was simply a descent into hell. I found 3 weeks out of the convent, I'm in jail. How does that happen? And there was more than one incident of that. I found the degradation that went with the kind of drinking I did, and at the end of that, I signed myself into 999 Queen Street, which was the mental institute, which was really an insane asylum. My brother found me there, took me to the West. It's now 1966, and it was in the fall there that Dr. Hoffer sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I already told you, I stayed there for 5.5 years, and in the meantime, I had, my alcoholism had absolutely spiraled downwards. It had spiraled me downwards, I should say. I had married this alcoholic psychiatrist. They used to say, their neuroses are complementary. The rocks in his head fit the holes in hers. And that was probably the truth. He too was alcoholic, sober when I met him. And I remember Dr. Hoffer shaking his head when he knew this man. I was still a patient, and we were going out on dates. And, you know, the very first time I went with on that date, my gut said, don't do this. But there was another part of me said, oh, my goodness, you are a nobody, and this psychiatrist wants you? Oh, well, we'll fix that. We'll train him the way we want him. Yeah, right. And the day came, you see, 5.5 years, and we both were drinking at this time, and in the last year and a half of my drinking, we lost everything. You know, the houses went, the cars went, the housekeeper went. Any pretensions that looked like a normal life went. I couldn't go to work anymore. He couldn't go to work anymore, and I'll tell you, disaster can hit very quickly. And so I wound up on a park bench. That shouldn't happen to an ex-nun. They don't teach you how to live on a park bench in the convent. My family, you know, if you knew them, they are the straightest arrows that you ever want to meet. Good, decent, church-going, spiritual, fine people. And then there was me on the park bench. And I woke up in a psych ward, which shouldn't surprise you, and there were two men sitting at the foot of my bed, and they really were there. One was a psychiatrist, and one was a private detective who'd been hired to find me. And little was I to know that the end was approaching. I think I've said enough that you can that I have identified myself and the awfulness of this disease. I drank anything. I drank lots of anything. I took whatever you gave me, whether it came as alcoholic or whether you sniffed it or took it as pills or whatever. I needed to change the way I felt. I couldn't stand that raw pain of just being sober and being on the planet. So, it's the morning of May the 20th. And the nurse walked me to the washroom. And I never want to forget what I saw in that washroom mirror. I had teeth knocked out. My hair was straggly. I weighed 85 pounds. This eye was sticking out, and it was purple, and I had a big purple U on my face. And I said to the nurse, I've become a woman of the streets. And she said, yes, you have. What are you going to do about it? So she took me to breakfast and back to my room. And that was the question that rolled around in my head. What are you going to do about it? I don't know. So I thought about it. What are my options? I was so broken at the time that if you had said to me, here, we've got this great job for you. We'll pay you $100,000 a year or whatever. I'd have had to say no. I couldn't look after myself. I couldn't put two decent thoughts together. So how am I going to look after myself? And I thought, well, are you going to live as a prostitute and spend the rest of your life on the street selling your body every day and every day so you can drink alcohol? That's a pretty bleak question. A pretty bleak prospect. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And I couldn't think of another thing that I could do. I was totally out of plans. And I was a woman who could always manipulate and think of some way, somewhere to go, some lie to tell, some way to get somebody to feel sorry for me and to do something for me. And that morning, I was out of plans. What a blessed place to be, to know that you can't do it yourself. So I decided I was going to take my life. I just couldn't do it anymore. And I wasn't kidding. And I called the nurse and I asked her to bring me my clothes. So she went to get my clothes. And while I stood there, I had a spiritual experience. In a heartbeat, the compulsion to drink was lifted. I was 40 years old. I'd been drinking alcoholically since 5. And it was the thing that had guided my behavior every day of my life. Who's got the booze? How much is there? What are we going to have to pay for it? Where are we going to drink it? Da-da, da-da, da-da. It's all I lived for. That magical thing that happened when I took this stuff. And the compulsion to drink was gone. And I knew it was gone. How you know some of these things, I don't know. I'm not being cocky about this, but honest, I knew that I was what, there was no compulsion in me. It was just a different being that stood there. But I also had enough experience. I knew something. And that was that I did not know how to live. And any time that I had had temporary, you know, a month or two of not drinking, I always went back to drinking because I didn't know how to live. Life got in the way, and I didn't know how to handle my emotions. I didn't know how to deal with you. I just was clueless, and I said, you know, I don't know how to live. And if I'm going to live sober, you're going to have to send me somebody, and if you do, I will obey. There was a rap on the door. As I stand here, like it sounds as if that kind of thing can't happen. As I stand here on my honor, that's exactly what happened. And a man stood at that door, and I think he really was there. I've told this story many times, and I've always hoped that somebody would come forward and say I was that man. Nobody has. But he said, are you an alcoholic? He said, I saw you at breakfast, and I guess you're in trouble, are you? And I said, yes. He said, are you alcoholic? I said, well, yeah, do you want to make something of it? And he said, no, I came to help you. And through that man's auspices, I got out of the institution, and he took me to a place called Donwood. And Donwood, you know, this is where a series of things started to happen that shouldn't happen. But they did. Nurse interviewed me, said, you should be here, but you have no money, so you can't stay. And from the time I walked from her office to the front door, Dr. Bell was in the hallway barking orders, saying, see to it that woman gets a bed right now. And that was my first 28 days, see? And Donwood was the perfect place. I hated God. I hated Alcoholics Anonymous. Donwood was the perfect place. They didn't push AA. They didn't push God. And so I started a little bit getting well, and they gave me a few dollars when I left so I could get a room, and I got a room on Skid Row. I opened the door, and I went, never seen a place like that before. And I was to live there for a year. And I have to tell you, I'm grateful for that experience, because it was the necessary experience that began the ego deflation in depth which I so badly needed. You know, hearing what I've said, you would think that somebody like me would be free of ego. Not so. I was full of ego. I was full of self-centeredness. It's all about me, and I didn't even know that. Because it's as self-centered to say I'm nothing as it is to say I'm the greatest. And, of course, my psychiatrist said, not my husband, the other guy, he said, get a job, and I got a job. I'm going to tell you about my first 21 years, because time is going, and there are a couple of things I really want to share. I can talk about the first 21 years and just tell you facts. The first 6 months I lived on Skid Row, swept floors and answered telephones, and walked very small. Somebody said to me one day, how did you survive? I don't think I was capable of thinking. I just put one foot ahead of the other and took that little bit of money and went to the store and bought a few potatoes or whatever. Husband couldn't get past who he was, you know. He used to run treatment centers and da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, and that's his story is not mine. This is what I'm telling you. And he just couldn't get out of the paralysis that he was in. So that was kind of the first 6 months. Didn't go to AA, didn't want to go to AA, didn't pray, nothing. Just put one foot ahead of the other. The next 6 months, something changed, because one morning I was at the institution and a man met me in the hallway, and he said, would you like to come to a meeting with me? I didn't know what he was talking about. I'll go anywhere with you. Nobody had asked me for a long time. I went with him, and I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in my newfound sobriety. I don't remember much about that time. I just know that I walked in, they said, keep coming back, and I remember thinking, I don't have nice clothes. I am a mess. I haven't got anything pretty to say, and yet they say to me, keep coming back. What a gift it is that we in Alcoholics Anonymous, who are sober, have to give and welcome and open our hearts and our arms and welcome those newcomers and let them know that they are precious to us and that they can get well. That's the message I got. After I was there a little while, I got a sponsor. She had blonde hair, gold earrings, and a white suit. Aren't those brilliant qualifications for a sponsor? She told me one thing I needed to hear. She said, you can get well despite what he does. And then she'd tell me what an SOB her husband was. But I got the message. She said, you can get well despite what he does. And I needed that. Because January the 1st, 1967, anger absolutely overwhelmed me. I had an iron in my hand, and awful compulsion. I thought, he's not expecting it, that blankety blank. I'm going to take this iron and just go bang in his face. That'll teach him for all the violence he's done. And I heard her voice say, you can get well despite what he does. And I put the iron down, and I remember I ran into the bathroom and got on my knees, and I cried and I prayed. And that was kind of then the end of those 6 months. Some other things happened in there. But at the end of that time, I got a teaching job, and that was a God shot. And for the next 20 years, I would say from 2 to 7, I really worked hard, and my sponsor got drunk, but I got another sponsor, and he taught me some really serious things. I should say in that first year, those two men in that group took me aside and they said, you have to do the steps. You know, I don't believe this business that we wait with people and have them do the steps later. I would have died, I believe, had I not done this. They took me aside. I was so scrambled, I couldn't read by myself. They said, if you come early, we'll read the book to you, and we'll tell you what to do. And that's how I did my first series of steps. It wasn't perfect, but you know, it was what I was capable of, and it allowed me to stay. And what came out of that was I realized who the problem was. By this time, I was 41 years old, and I still didn't know. I thought you were the problem. I thought it was the church, the Pope, Mother Superior, mother and dad, the farm, etc., etc. I was full of everybody else being wrong, not me. And I saw it when I did my fourth step. It's me. And so I was able to stay. Now I had a teaching job. I was making good money. I'll tell you, a lot better than you make sweeping floors and answering telephones. And I didn't know how to fit in that school. And that's a whole story by itself. But there were good people in that school, other teachers who took me aside, and they taught me things that I didn't know how to do. And I've always been a good teacher, so that wasn't the problem. It was the relationships with students. You know, and students will saw you off at the knees. They're not worried about your complexes and your old beliefs and all that kind of stuff. So it was an interesting time, and at the end of seven years, I was busy in AA. I was a good member of AA, and I had changed some. And it was at that time that one of my friends said, you should start buying houses. Well, I had spent those 7 years paying off our debts. I was divorced from my husband now. I had had another man in my life, and that poor fella couldn't stay sober. No problem to me. I know how to stay sober, and baby, you're going to learn. One morning, I found myself over his head. He's lying on the bed, and I've got his ears in my hands. And he's saying, Mildred, I need some beer. I want to taper off. I said, no, you pray. He said, I don't want to pray. I want beer. And I pounded his head on the bed, and I said, you pray, you son of a bitch. And then I went to Al-Anon. God bless you, Al-Anons. I was a mess when I came into AA. I was a bigger mess when I came into Al-Anon. You know, mouthing, oh, well, I've been sober 4 years. Wasn't I a sparkling example of what the program can do? But they welcomed me anyway and taught me some really great things. And then, as I said, 7 years, I'd had this really tough sponsor, and I learned to buy houses. And for the next 10 years, that was it. Men and money, that was my concern. Oh, I was going to AA, and I was doing all the stuff, but I was, you know, making a lot of money, and I had, well, men. We'll just leave an adjective in front of that out. The part of that I think is interesting is that at the end of that 21 years, I had changed a great deal on the outside. Something in me was not right on the inside. See? And I don't think that you and I can orchestrate that kind of thing. You can tell me what I should do. See, what I didn't realize was that my head and my soul were so full of intellectual stuff that I had learned about God that I didn't realize I had no experience of God. And if you live behind the kind of walls that I lived, you also can't have relationships with people. You can have acquaintanceships, you can do stuff with people, but inside you're lonely and despairing. And what I realized was the money didn't cut it, the houses didn't cut it, the cars didn't cut it, the promotions at work didn't cut it. There was something wrong with me, and I didn't know how to fix it. And I'm saying to you, that is a God place. Because I came to a place again at 21 years sober where I had said goodbye to the last man, not the last one on earth, just the last one that I had. And then the next year, I left my teaching job. I can still hear the door shut because my soul just went, ugh, because my job was me. I was identified with that. And what am I going to do? And a couple of months out of that, I decided to take my life. That doesn't mean that AA doesn't work. Somebody once said to me, don't say that at a meeting. Somebody's going to think the program doesn't work. No, it just means it wasn't working for me. Or that there was an intermediate step. There was something that wasn't right in me. It was an inner deal. It was at that time that I began to realize for 21 years I had been saying the third step prayer. And the third step prayer says, relieve me of the bondage of self. And I would have had to tell you I didn't know what the bondage of self was. See, what happened was God never makes a mistake. I made up my mind. It works for you. I didn't doubt that it worked. It doesn't work for me. I am not happy, joyous, and free inside. I don't know how to do it. And so I made up my mind, that's it. And one more time, I had a spiritual experience where one moment I was looking that away, and that power turned me around, and I was looking 180 degrees into the light. And I knew it was going to be all right. Didn't know how. And about 3 weeks later, and the next morning, I remember waking up, and I knew what I had to do. Get out of bed. Put one foot ahead of the other. And don't lie there and feel sorry for yourself. Suit up and show up and do the best you know how. And 3 weeks later, the phone rang. And it was a Jesuit priest. And he said, Mildred, I hear about you. Yeah, that's good. He said, would you like to come and give some retreats? I said, oh, Father, I just laughed. I said, have you any idea how many times I've been excommunicated? He said, no, and I don't really care. So that was to begin. I went to do my first retreat to a bunch of 65 women. I don't like women. I'm willing to talk to them. I could do that. The last conference I gave, I started bawling. Not crying pretty like they do in the movies. I bawled. And I said, and I had not planned this. See, I know how to shed a strategic tear when men are around. Not with women. And here I am bawling. And out come the words. I don't have a friend in the world. Lots of acquaintances. And I knew that was the truth. I knew that I was so locked into myself, I wouldn't let you anywhere near me. Not the real me, because if you knew me, well, you didn't like me anyway. That's the way I felt. And people would say, oh, you intimidate me. And I was sick enough to think that was a compliment. I know now people were coming up against those walls, and I can still do that today. I can put up those walls if something just hits me the wrong way, just like that. I'm not proud of that, but I know that I can do that. And it's only God's grace that has... That morning, the walls came down. I'm a great believer that God grows our souls. We don't grow our souls. We do the actions. We change the behavior. We change the words. We do as much as we can. It's like if I want tomatoes, I've got to have a part in that. I've got to plant some seeds and tend it, or I've got to get some plants and plant them, or make some money and go buy them. It's not going to happen if I just sit there and say, you know, God, I'd sure like some tomatoes. But I know who grows my soul. Because when I look at the way my life has gone, I could not have orchestrated the events that happened, and that happened at exactly the right time. The right phone call, the right word. I remember one time, for example, Marty and I were friends, and I went to Winnipeg to spend a weekend with Marty. And in the course of our conversation, I said something, and Marty recommended a book. And I said, oh, I don't like that author. I won't be buying that. Do you remember that? And he just let me go, and I came back to Toronto on Sunday night. And Monday, I had to go to the bookstore. Had totally forgotten about this. And I can still remember walking down the aisle. And all the books were vertical, except one was horizontal in the distance. Bing! The light went on, and I thought, it couldn't be. It was. I bought it, and yes, it had something in it that I had... Did it fix my life? No! But what it did was it took me to the next... It gave me the information to get over the hump that I needed to get over to get to the next piece. And that's really what this deal is about. We don't get fixed all in one big thing. And the walls coming down allowed something else to happen. They allowed me to understand, to get in touch with what the bondage of self really has been in my life. You know what it was? The bondage of self that kept me tied to old ways of behavior was those old belief systems that I took on. Nobody loves me. I'm not important. Life is scary. Nobody helps me. You see, what's the problem with that? Number one, they're not the truth. The book tells me I must get to the point where I know that God is everything. And if I'm saying nobody loves me and this is wrong and that is wrong, I'm focused in the wrong place. If I look to you for my solution, I've got the wrong thing. You see, those old beliefs were driving my feelings. They were driving my motivations. And that's what I began to see. And again, God put somebody in my path who sat me down and worked with me and showed me that I didn't have to live that way anymore, that those were indeed the wounds of childhood. You know, somewhere in me, I guess I knew that, but I didn't know how to deal with it. And God sent me somebody who showed me what to do and how I could deal with the bondage of self. I can tell you, I never say that third step prayer these days without being mindful of that. Relieve me of the bondage of self so that I can better do thy will. Because I'm telling you, when I'm listening to those old voices that say, nobody cares about you, you're just a nothing. You can't fix it and they won't fix it. I'll tell you, I can be a raging maniac so fast it's pathetic. And that's when I put up the walls. And if I put up the walls, you can't get in and I can't get out. And I need to dance with you because it's in the dance that we do together. That's why this is so great. You know, we get together and I'm sure we all have our own little deals about what it feels like to be in a group of people. Like sometimes I've experienced this. I can be in a group of people and feel, Oh, geez, nobody cares about me. Nobody sees me. I'm just alone. And I'll bet you if we had hands up, there'd be lots of hands that go up. And there'd be people that use this. Well, we won't go into what we might use this as an opportunity for. Anyway, that prepared me for the great event of my life. And that was that, you see, when my mother and dad died, I'm just going to take a few minutes to finish off talking about Dora and my relationship with Dora. About 3 years before Dora died, I was home, and she, after my parents died, she went to live with one of my sisters. And they had five little kids at the time, and they took her in, and they gave her a home. And she was very happy there. And one day, as I was leaving, she said, "Come here, come here." And we had another hug. And something happened to me that day. I realized I come from a family that's kind of stiff and cold. We weren't a big huggy family when we were kids. And I realized something as I put my arms around her. I felt it was like the love and the life force out of me just pouring into her to fill her up. And she said to me, I realized she hadn't had much of that. You know, she used to rock the little babies, my nieces and nephews, and they'd say, "Don't let Aunt..." I don't know if I can say this. They'd say, "Don't let Auntie Dora rock us." And my sister would say, "Why?" "Because she holds us so tight, we think we're going to smother." Why? She was looking for some love and some comfort. And that day, I felt I understood all that. And she said to me, "Do you still cry at night?" And I said, "No." She said, "I don't either." She said, "I'm real happy." And when I went back to Toronto, I spoke to my Jesuit spiritual director, and he said, "You're really sick." He said, "You don't get it. You think God needs a big intellect to fix a soul?" He said, "I don't think so. What you just heard was her saying, 'I am at peace with my life, I'm at peace with God, and I'm ready to go.'" And then 3 years later, I got the call. I hadn't really thought about it. I guess I didn't want to think about it. And it was my brother-in-law, and he said, "Dora's dying." And he said, "You must come right away if you want to see her." And of course, I wanted to see her, but I was also scared. I'd never been at a deathbed. And two of my sponsees were in my house that night. And they said, "Of course you're going." They packed my suitcase, got me a ticket, arranged everything that had to be arranged, and the next morning they poured me on the plane. And I was shaking. And, you know, I thought, I hope she's gone by the time I get there. I'm ashamed to say it, but I was scared. I thought, what will I do? Now, I want to back up to about a year before that. One day I got a phone call from a close friend, and she said, "Mildred, my mother just died, and I am calling you first because," she said, "I want to thank you for helping me be present to my mother." Well, I didn't want to ask too many questions because she had just, you know, her mother had just died. But I was thinking, what's she talking about? She's got the wrong person. We've never talked about death. What she was talking about was I had taken her through the steps, and the steps had been powerful and had opened her up. And so when her mother was dying, she knew what to do. She said, "You know, I sang to my mother," and she said, "I stroked her. She was in a coma, but," she said, "I could feel the presence of the angels as her soul went off." Well, that was that conversation. And, you know, a year later, isn't it wonderful how this system works? It's not my decision how what I put out there, who it's going to benefit. But one thing I do know, that the power that is within me wants to use me in ways that it can't use you, and it wants to use you in ways that it can't use me. And if I put that out, I don't have to worry about what's going to come back, because it has been proved to me time and time and time again. I can't fix my life. But what happens is somebody comes, you give and you receive. And as you give, so you receive. And I had given to her, she had given to me, and I was able to stand at Dora's deathbed. I think it is the greatest gift and the greatest proof to me that this program works, because I got off the plane. My brother was waiting. He said, Dora is still alive. I was still shaking. I got to the hospital bedroom, and all fear left me. All fear left me. And I went in there. And I was the one that rallied my brothers and sisters. I said, come, touch her. Put your hand on her. You can stroke her. And we sang. And there were songs I hadn't sung, you know, some of the songs on this day from the church. They would be songs that she would hear, that would resonate in her. And I stayed with her. Family went home. I stayed the night. Isn't it something that I got to do that? I stood by her bed that night, and we did a life review. And I talked to her about, let's make sure that our souls are clean and that we let everybody be free, you know, who we may feel hurt us and didn't treat us right, etc. And then in the morning, my brothers and sisters came, and we decided to pull the life support would be pulled 20 minutes before Dora died. And, you know, all night I was thinking, I hope she hears me. I hope she hears me. 20 minutes before she died, my sister-in-law, the one I didn't like, she was the one, at one time I was home and I said to my sister, who was giving a dinner party, who's coming, and she said, and she named off the people, and my sister-in-law was there coming, and she said, why don't you want her there? And I said, she's always so pretentious. She always talks about how much money they have and the powerful friends they have. And my sister, without stopping a beat, said, she only acts that way when you're around. There's a message. And she never even was a member of AA. That was the sister-in-law standing at that bed, who said to Dora, because Dora's mouth was open, and she said, Dora, you can close your mouth and swallow. It will be easier to breathe. And Dora did. And about 5 minutes before she died, that same thing happened. And then Dora was gone. And I have to tell you, that was the most sacred moment in my life. I felt I was in the presence of the mystery that I can't explain. And I felt the presence of my parents. I, who had been such a thorn in their side, particularly my mother. And I had done everything that I could do to feel at peace about that. And that morning, I felt those parents right there saying, you did good, little one. We're okay. Got back to Toronto and went to see my spiritual director. And I said to him, I told him what I had done. And I said, I would be so comforted if I knew that she really heard me. Again, he said, you're really thick. He said, if she responded to your sister-in-law 20 minutes before she died and 5 minutes before, surely she heard you. And I knew that what he said was the truth. I make missteps. God never does. I've learned to trust that. Sometimes I don't trust it, but God sends me people back into my life who remind me that everything is just the way it is. You're just the way you're supposed to be. I'm getting the lessons I need, and everything is in God's hands. It's in God's order. And so I thank you so much for allowing me the privilege of being here with you. Blessings to all.